This is it's an inspiring, challenging, influential Buddhist text from a man called Shantideva. He was a monk, a scholar monk, in the 8th century. And he lived in a monastic university called Nalanda. And if you've been to India, in the northeast of India, you might have visited the remains there. I know I went there 5 years ago, and it's just tremendous. I think they've only dug up about 10% of the monastic university, and there's still a lot underground. It's quite an amazing place. And in its heyday, I think it said over 10,000 monks and nuns lived there. So it was a huge place, and many, many visitors. People used to visit from different countries. So this piece that Shantideva wrote is called the Bodhicaryavatara, or a guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. So the Bodhisattva is one who's vowed to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And the puja we do, the ritual puja, is based on this text. Sangharakshita has taken parts of the text and put it together into our puja, so you might recognise phrases from time to time. And one way of thinking about the text is a devotional poem, and Shantideva leads us through various devotional moods, spiritual moods, designed to move us more and more towards enlightenment. At least in imagination, but our imaginations have, stimulated, and they can help us to become more oriented towards enlightenment. We might like to think of it as a spiritual journey. So this week we'll be exploring confession and going for refuge. So it starts off saying standing with folded hands before the Buddhas in the 10 directions, before the Bodhisattvas of great compassion, I acknowledge the harm I have caused in this life and past ages, the harm to myself, the harm to the three jewels, and the harm to other beings. So he's doing this in front of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. It's kind of this respect and reverence and in relationship with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And he's acknowledging the harm that he's caused to himself, to others. And so it's just really acknowledging that some of his actions have caused harm to himself and others. And so automatically that makes me think about karma, and karma having, actions have consequences. So when we speak or act from hatred, craving or ignorance, we cause ourselves suffering, and the opposite, it's more positive. So we cause ourselves and others pain. So you might like to think of that as negative patterns in ourselves that we've created and we're reinforcing through our actions. So the exercise we did before the break was a sort of a look into that. What have we done that we don't feel happy about? What do we regret? We're going to look at confession a bit later on, but it's very much this sense of acknowledging things we're not happy about, because we've all have done or said things that we haven't been happy about, and it's a way of acknowledging it but also moving on from it as well, saying, well, I don't want to do that again, and seeing if we can create more positive habits, more positive patterns. Maybe it's something we're doing time and time again, and we kind of want to let go of this particular negative habit, and we want to free ourselves from this habit so we can move forward. So the language of Shantideva, I don't know how you found the reading, but it's quite strong, isn't it? It's quite strong. So how can I escape the results of my karma? O guides of the world, please grasp me quickly so that death does not come before it is wiped out. And the way he talks, it's quite strong. And in a way, I don't know, it certainly reminds me in a way of the sort of the hellfire sermons designed to put the fear of God into you, from the Christian tradition. I don't know if that's, is that something that's, when you heard that, did you think, oh, that's not a side of Buddhism I'm particularly happy about, or what about all the rational stuff, or so did anyone find that a bit strong, a bit too much?
Yeah, the sort of thing I remember as a sort of growing up in a Catholic school and sort of God, the protector coming in, and so that word protector is sort of guardians of the universe, sometimes sort of
Oh, that's interesting.
It's sort of doesn't like school that much for those reasons. So when I hear that language, it's sort of like
yes.
We have to stop a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. Because in a way, when we hear certain phrases or words, we've often got associations with them, haven't we? Like confession or for instance, protectors. So we might hear that and then think, oh, what are do the Buddhas actually protect us literally? Do they? Can they stop flood and famine and wreak, sort of havoc on us as the God of the Old Testament is supposed to have done, sort of thing. An interesting the protector, it was an interesting area. The protector, the way the Buddha protects us is that the fact that he has gone beyond suffering, he's seen through the delusion and he's gained enlightenment. And he's offering a way for us as well. So it's protecting us, and because he's showing the way. He's showing the way out of our own suffering, and a way to enlightenment. So he's called a shower of the way. So it's an interesting what you were saying about protector. Yeah. Does that strike anyone else? Has anyone else been struck with some of that language? Sounds a bit Old Testament.
It's the same part of the puja that when I've been to the puja I struggle with. So again, save me from the realms of rebirth. I don't relate to the idea of rebirth. To do this stuff to save my, stop my karma, but it's like,
yes.
And then talking about people, the protector thing, it sounds like saints, it sounds like people on the clouds.
Right, yes.
We pray to.
I think it can be for a lot of people in the West, if we don't take, maybe we don't take on board the idea of rebirth, and we don't have to. But then when we come across an old text like this, who Shantideva is thoroughly in that whole tradition, as it were, of death and rebirth over many, many lives. And then we have this sort of, exactly as you're saying, I don't really go along with rebirth, so I'm not really, I don't go on, so I don't, can't really buy into this. In a way.
It's a jolt.
It's a bit of a jolt, yeah. Does anybody else find that with rebirth?
Found it initially. I started to think, certainly my actions reproduced themselves in this life, I didn't need to worry about later life.
So yeah.
Constantly repeating the same mistakes and getting myself into the same kind of trouble.
Yes.
So it applies just as much to that, save me from the consequence, the bad rebirths of my bad emotions in this in this life. And then the Buddha kind of says the same thing in the Dhammapada. He says, you know, if reincarnation is really, it really happens, then we should work to improve our karma. And if it's not, then you can make this life better as well. And I think I just thought about the puja in that way for a long time. And now it doesn't even seem, the distinction doesn't even seem to matter that much.
I like that. So it is almost we've got, the Buddhist tradition has, rebirth from life to life, but also, we re-become, become again and again, moment to moment, as it were, and we've got these patterns that we keep on repeating, as you said, just keep on going round and round in the same old pattern. And in a way, we're trying to free ourselves from those, habitual reactive patterns. So that's a good way of thinking about it. So would you say, do you approach the puja as sort of poetry, maybe? And so you don't sort of take it maybe so literally in a way now?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I feel like I take this the sentiment from it. I mean, I'm definitely afraid of suffering. I definitely want not to suffer again in the way that I have before. And I'm willing to go to, probably not willing to go to any lengths, but I'm willing to take some serious steps to prevent it.
Yes.
And so I kind of find that bit of the puja and that bit of the Bodhicharyavatara motivating for that reason.
Yes, yes.
I don't literally think I'm going to fall into the fires of hell, but I do think I could be a bit miserable.
No, that's really good. Yeah. Yes, it is like, it's not like in Buddhism, there isn't a God that's going to punish us and, and we've got to appease that God, as it were. This act, karma is something which is inherent in the universe. It's something that operates almost automatically, if you like. So, and we can affect our experience of our life by how we act. So, so it's sort of taking responsibility for our actions and realizing that we've got, and the future is in our hands, as it were. And it's like you say, we don't want to suffer. We don't want to get ourselves into bad states. And actually, we've got choices. We can actually begin to change our experience for the better.
It's about outside. Sometimes we look at that God element and that outside force. Similarity with the Buddha element and that sort of outside force. When you were talking about the scriptures, save me from such and such. Does it have to be somebody else? Say for example, you're saying save me. You can't. Can you not be talking to something within yourself? Because I was reading a while ago, and they're saying about the idea of God, in the brain has a certain certain reaction to the brain, which sort of stops us feeling a certain loneliness. It apparently had an evolutionary impact, the way we were things. And with the patterns and stuff, it's similar. We were reading a book also saying that human beings have patterns in the same way as birds do. That they're socially the way they go between each other. And I just find it's interesting, the idea of the other and the self. Sometimes you could say, save me. But it doesn't necessarily have to be the other, because Buddha is an experience, right, that we're looking to, rather than the person. It's the experience that Buddha thought, not the arms and the legs or the head and the body or the moon and the stars, the actual thing itself that you want to step into.
It's interesting, isn't it, how we, we tend to want to, well, with the Buddha, is the Buddha out there? Is enlightenment out there? I mean, it's our own potential in a way. So it's something that we can become. But we can't wholly say it's ourself either, as well.
Because there's that Zen tradition where they say, what should you do if you meet the Buddha? And they say, kill him. Because you should be able to, it's like a trick, I suppose, because it's like there's that, but then you're trying to experience. It's not. I don't think it's something to bow to.
Yeah. there's, with that, you need to meet the Buddha first. So that's the sort of, you've kind of got to get quite far before you can do that.
Say something.
Sure.
The protective thing, because I just sort of talking about habits and, you know, and a bit hellish. I lose my rag quite a lot, but it's a habit. And usually feel quite bad afterwards. So I don't know about. Well, it's like a hellish mental state. I've been to a real hell on earth, which was Auschwitz concentration camp, but. It can feel hellish, you know, when I lose my rag and do it at the tea break and talk to Dai Bandhu. I found a couple of things that can help talking in protectors is first of all to acknowledge it, and particularly if I can, to the person, is to apologise. So the protector thing, actually, I can recommend Buddhist mantras. So it's a bit like, I don't know if there is an actual Buddha outside of me. I sort of take it on trust. But it's like something I can do myself. There has to be something I can do myself. I can't rely on that, you know, literal figure outside of me. So chanting a mantra, it does help. There is one there's a Vajrasattva mantra, which is a figure of, particularly to do with, you know, forgiveness. So I can recommend that, and it just fits in with the rebirth thing that someone said down here, Groundhog Day, Bozo Bozo, again and again, you know, making that same kind of mistake, but it's like I have to kind of, I'm not going to wait for the next life, I don't really know if that will happen, you know, just have to do it now. So if I've hurt someone, apology. You know, that, I was trying to say that's what kind of what I would try and do.
Yeah.
You know.
Great. Thank you. So just to say that, so the idea of Buddhist, you know, karma isn't judgment. It's not retribution or punishment. So yeah, it's something that's natural in the universe. You might even say that the universe, it has an ethical dimension. You could almost say that the universe is ethical in a certain sense. So it's something that's inherent in us, inherent in all life, in all when we have self-consciousness. And the Buddhas don't administer karma. Their attitude is always one of compassion and metta. And also they can't take away the results of your karma either. So whilst we might ask for help, it's not like we're asking them to intervene and sort of make it all right for us. So unethical actions have unpleasant consequences. So he says, how can I escape the results of my karma? And he says, here and now I go for refuge to the Buddhas who protect the universe. So here we come across the phrase go for refuge. And this is something very, very central in Buddhism. In fact, Sangharakshita says it's the, you know, the most central act of the Buddhist is going for refuge. It's an act. And it's something we would do with the whole of ourselves, with body, speech and mind. And we go for refuge to the three jewels, to the Buddha, the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha and the Sangha. In particular, those disciples of the Buddha who've actually made significant progress. And so going for refuge, one way of thinking about going for refuge, because again this is a phrase I think I've struggled with quite a lot over the years, because what does it mean, go for refuge? I mean, in some ways it's refuge from suffering, you know, we want refuge And what the Buddha is pointing out is that actually we go for refuge all the time. It's not something that we do particularly in Buddhism. We're actually going for refuge all the time, but it's what we go for refuge to. So what do we go for refuge to? What do we go that maybe consciously, maybe unconsciously, we think is going to give us lasting fulfillment and satisfaction? Because it's something very naturally human that we do, don't we? So the way we live our lives, we are always going for refuge. One way of thinking about going for refuge is turning about, turning around. So aligning ourselves with the currents in the universe that help us grow and develop spiritually, and pointing ourselves in the direction of enlightenment, saying, actually, it's the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha are the true refuge. They're the refuges that are really going to help me in the end, are really going to provide security in a certain sense, but also it's only enlightenment really that can give us lasting and lasting fulfillment. Another way of thinking about the phrase going for refuge is commitment. So I was reading a very good book. If you're interested in exploring the puja and exploring ritual, there's a really good book called Ritual and Devotion and in Buddhism. And I think we might have it in the bookshop. And it's in here, Sangharakshita talks about the Sevenfold Puja as like, it's like a spiritual journey. It's as if you see a beautiful mountain peak in the distance, and are, you know, you have a feeling of awe and wonder towards that beautiful mountain peak. And in the first couple of stages of the puja, you make offerings, you recite verses, you really experience this awe and wonder. And of course, and the metaphor obviously is of this peak is the peak of enlightenment, the beautiful mountain peak of enlightenment. But after the first two stages, you realise the gap between you and enlightenment. Yeah. So you realise actually there's such a way to go on this journey. But as all journeys, they all begin with a single step. So we need to act, and that's what going for refuge really is. It's actually acting, it's taking that first step and then taking another step. It's always so when we go for refuge, we always take the next step, and it's taking that step towards the mountain peak. No matter how long it's going to take, we've aimed ourselves for enlightenment, and we're taking the next step. And that next step might be small, it might be great. And I find that language of taking the next step very, very helpful, actually, because sometimes we can just feel like this huge thing. What is this thing we're undertaking to try and to go towards enlightenment? But actually, we can do it in small steps. And I'm just wondering, well, maybe what's the next step for you? What's the next step that you want to take? And that might be, it might be very something very small, it might be something larger. You know, you might think, actually, I really want to get my meditation practice regular. You know, I want to meditate every day. And or you might think, I really need to work on my speech. And, I'm quite harsh in my speech. Or maybe you think, oh, actually, I want to make a commitment to the spiritual life. And you might, you know, for instance, you might decide to become a Mitra. And last week we had some Mitra ceremonies. This is where men and women made a commitment to practicing Buddhism in their lives. So how does that language of going for refuge strike you? that's something that makes, does it resonate with you, or taking the next step?
I always had a difficulty with it, going for refuge. I mean, it's really the last few years that I've come into a much deeper understanding, a better relationship with the phrase, because for me it sort of always felt like going for refuge is like hiding away from something, or taking it out, you know, which it is in a sense.
Yes.
But for me it didn't, practice in Buddhism didn't feel like that. It felt really like actually facing life and really facing up to things and taking responsibility for your life.
Yes.
So for me, the phrase going for refuge was a bit incompatible with that until I started to equate it more, like you were saying, with, well, it's going for refuge from suffering. But I couldn't line those two things up for a long time, because it felt like, it didn't feel like going for refuge, it felt like actually coming out of the refuge.
Yes.
Because we take, like you say, we take refuge in our lives in so many ways.
Yes, yes.
That aren't real refuges.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
No, thank you. I think I definitely resonate with that, with that sense of, well, in a way I don't want to take refuge in a way. I want to just be open to life in a way, and really live life. Anyone find can anyone think of anything we go for refuge to? What do we go for refuge to? We're always going for refuge to something.
Pleasure.
Pleasure. That's a good one. It's a key one, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. That's quite common, isn't it? You know, sort of hedonism, or it could just be simple, couldn't it?
Yeah. Or even just anything to avoid pain.
Sometimes.
Don't like this. That's pleasurable, I'll do that instead.
Yeah.
So working out the 5 different ways which you can get pleasure for sitting down, or 5 different ways if I was in this social situation that I could make it more pleasurable.
Start
seeing the depth of your craving for it.
Yes.
Looking for it.
Yeah. It's really natural, isn't it? Just such a natural thing to want pleasure in.
Stimulation,
yeah. Do you want to say more?
Like food. Materialism. Types of stimulation. So like, for example, when people have junk food and just eat and eat and eat and don't think about it.
Yeah.
Or people buy stuff.
Yeah.
To, you know, to be stimulated.
It's like give us maybe a bit of a buzz, or, I mean, maybe we're not consciously thinking, oh, I want lasting fulfillment from my, you know, burger or something like that. But but it's kind of probably how we're acting in a way, isn't it? You know, we want it from food, maybe, or, you know, alcohol or drugs or whatever it is. Maybe we're wanting, you know, the pleasure, you know, maybe the peak, the hit or something. Yeah. Anything?
Yeah, I was going to say, for me, I often go for refuge to status.
And
feeling of, like, being someone.
Being
important.
Yes.
Sort of have to, otherwise I worry that I won't sort of be anything. I often try to prop up my sense of maybe with a sense of status,
right,
in my work or in my relationship, my friendships, my family as well.
That's really interesting, isn't it? What you said, when, if you don't have that, if you don't prop it up, then this is almost the opposite comes in, doesn't it? But if I'm not someone important, then I'm someone unimportant. That's very honest.
It's something about that, the whole word important, isn't it? I was listening to
was actually watching something on TV, and it was about a photographer who was taking all these photos in the time of the rock bands, had photos of the Beatles backstage and all these things popular. And everyone was saying how important this guy was. I took this photo and it was really important for this and that. And I was just thinking to myself, important for what though? What importance? But in that world, to these people in this TV show, that was so important to them that this, this whole thing was important. And you know, it is important. I'm not saying it's not important, but that did make me think, important for what? What is all this for? You know, what's the importance of it all? And these people they're in that industry, in that world. And I'm in my own world. You know, I work at a hospital. It's exactly the same there. You just think what you're doing at the hospital is the most important thing. And you're committed to that thing, and you've got to turn up on time. Is it important? I mean, is it really, really important? I think so much around that word importance. Just when I heard it, it reminded me of that.
It's interesting that the whole world, is it? We can live in a whole world, can't we?
Whatever world it might be, and you think that's it.
I've just been watching some Alan Bennett, some of his early BBC productions, and there's this man who's retired, and he's visited by a colleague of his who tells him all about the work, you know, and they say, well, and so-and-so on the fifth floor is saying this, da, 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 da. And it's just like, and he's saying, but, you know, there's a lot more than just working for whoever it is, you know. And it was really interesting because, you know, she's totally in this whole, you know, it's almost the whole of life is within this firm, as it, you know, she's committed herself totally to this job. So maybe that brings us to things like career and things like that, where we might go for refuge to a career. You actually think, maybe unconsciously, oh, this is going to provide me with fulfilment at a deep level.
I feel like the things which I go to refuge to, which are most dangerous, are things which kind of provide quite a lot of things. Like career, it's not just status, it's also like, well, say, you know, you get a job, I'm about to study again, so maybe I get a job at university, you know, lots of nice people around, lots of good social interaction, you're striving for some kind of higher ideal, you know, to produce really good work, to contribute to human knowledge, you know, so you have this thing to aim for, which seems really important in a sense beyond mundane life. You know, it can be quite satisfying, and you know, it, all of those things can seem like they're like providing lasting fulfilment. They're probably actually, and, you know, and a good dose of status and everything else, but it's probably actually not. But it's very difficult to see that. It's even difficult to see that, even talking about it now.
Yeah.
I'm sure part of me believes that that could provide lasting fulfilment.
Of course. And it's not to say there's nothing wrong, you know, like working in a hospital or university or whatever. You know, lots of good things, you know. Just how we... It's our relationship to those activities, isn't it? If we sort of buy into the whole thing.
I was even thinking a bit about like this now in the university that you're talking about. I mean, there's like 10,000 people there, and did it start around 300? It was around for hundreds of years, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah, as far as I know. Yeah.
And now it's just completely buried under.
Well, that's true.
And you would have thought that what they were doing was important, you know.
I guess not everyone agreed, so we'll go into that. Do you want to?
Just to sort of put maybe a subtly different angle on what the last few people have been saying, I wonder if something on the lines of personal ambition can be something we go to refuge for.
That's
something maybe slightly distinct from the impact or the worth of that job or that thing that we do. Perhaps I think it's quite easy and very, you know, something that seems very important in our culture that one has this personal ambition, one to push oneself forward to achieve for oneself. Almost, well, I think actually quite literally above and beyond the impact of what you do for others, the impact of what you do for yourself can be seen to be the thing to really, that's really most important.
Yes, yes.
And
so it's, yes.
I think to sort of consider that for a moment, maybe it is slightly warped in a way. Warped maybe is not the right word, but maybe we can see this sort of contradiction there with the values that we're trying to lead towards.
Yeah, I think it's, well, I think what you're saying about personal, I mean, it's the personal ambition, maybe some of that is, you know, reinforcing this self-centered behaviour that we've, you know, we can naturally have, and just keeping that going and making ourselves the centre of it all.
Yeah, quite isolated, I suppose.
It's a danger, isn't it? Yeah.
I really relate to that in relation to actually Buddhism. I think I'm quite ambitious. Person, and that ambition sort of really comes into how I come to the centre, because I come to the centre with a sense of ambition, and I just want to sort of appropriate the sort of joy and the positive emotion, and I want to sort of have it for myself. I'm not really interested that much with other people. So I just find myself doing that quite a lot. So my ambition gets, sort of comes into hearing.
Maybe ambition and aspiration can be things that we can sort of see that they're very similar or mix up.
Importance can change, can't it? Like, importance of what's important can change. Like, say, for example, you might start thinking, okay, I'm going to get the most beautiful wife, golf, and then you might have a child, and you go, okay, the child might seem more important, you know, after a while, being a girlfriend, or what's going on, how good she looks, or whatever. You know, certain priorities can change, even like money. We invest value in money, otherwise, it's paper. You know, it doesn't mean anything unless you someone actually wants to trade for someone else. It doesn't matter. So the values, they shift and change, and always think, like, for instance, when I was young, always watching, like, the gazelle and the tiger and the lion. The lion just the gazelle, I'm like, okay, shouldn't you stop it? But is it right? But it just is that particular way. And there's a way to it. Something is, we invest the idea, this is right, that's wrong.
I also think that there are loads of people who go, they start off and then they go the wrong direction. For example, like people in fashion, they are in fashion and then afterwards they realise that that's not the right sort of direction, that they sort of turn to alternatives, like, for example, eco-fashion. But these are just lessening it. It's not going the other direction, it's just sort of slowing it down. And there's also this sense of a fear that it's like, where do you go if you're not there?
If you're not sort of,
if you're not going in that direction, that
right,
you're very familiar with.
Yes.
I think
you're right. In a way, we can have those sorts of fears when we embark on, say, on the spiritual life, and because it is sort of not doing the conventional thing and maybe stepping out into the unknown. It's where we need the spiritual community to support us, our spiritual friends. Okay. Just want to move on a bit because time's going on. So he goes for refuge to three jewels, Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And in the fourth stage of the puja, we confess our unskillful action. So I want to unpack the whole thing with confess. I think confession is, again, one of those words that some of us might have quite a lot of associations with. But again, thinking about the journey, we've taken the step, we've taken our first step over and over again. We've committed ourselves, recommitted ourselves to the journey towards enlightenment. But actually what we find is that we've got an awful lot of baggage, we've got stuff dragging us you know, we end up with a huge suitcase and we've got a big rucksack on our back, and, you know, and this baggage is our unskillful action. It's stuff we've done. It's unhelpful, negative habits. It stops us having brighter, more expansive states of mind, feeling more interconnected. As we were saying before the break, you know, these actions that we do, that we regret, can often make us feel disconnected. And the movement, you know, that we, you know, the spiritual progress, we become more and more connected. So if we, you know, let go of those negative habits that keep us from connection, then we can experience more and more freedom. And this really is confession. So confession is acknowledging our unskillfulness, and through that acknowledgement we can feel lighter and our conscience can be clearer. And we're able to practice more wholeheartedly. So, confession. So what it's not, okay? So we're not confessing our sins to the priest, okay? Who's going to absolve us, and then we can, you know, go out and do it again. You know? So it's not that sort of confession. As I was saying before, the Buddha can't take away the results of your karma. And the basis of confession is psychological rather than theological. So it's something, it's very much using, you know, the human psychology. It's really acknowledging stuff we regret, actions that we regret. So confession includes regret, willingness to undo the effects of the act. So that might be, say, if we've taken something that we regret, then it's making amends, maybe repaying money. And a commitment not to repeat the action. We can confess to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. But also, maybe a more concrete way is confessing to our friends, our spiritual friends. And here, the friend needs to take our confession seriously and not dismiss it or make it all right and say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, don't worry about it. And we might feel that maybe we're powerless to completely stop this negative habit, but we might want to do it just for a short period. Okay, so we might think, actually, I'm getting drunk quite often. I don't want to get drunk anymore. But actually, to give up is beyond me at the moment. But actually, say, well, okay, I'm going to do it for a month. See how we get on, and just make that. And what that does is that weakens the habit. We begin to weaken our negative habits and allow more positive habits to arise. So I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts about that. Does confession, does it have any resonance for you? You know, the Buddhist confession? Does it smack of feeling guilty? And sin.
I think for me, it's where it lines up with compassion. So I feel compassion for myself.
Oh yeah.
I don't
beat
myself up about it.
Yes.
I'm not very good at this.
Yeah.
And often we're not very good at things for really good reasons. Like something might have happened in our past that triggers certain. The reasons we have these habits and why they're hardwired.
Can come from
difficult moments that we experience. So I find that combination of having compassion for myself and fully acknowledging the negative pattern is
that was
very powerful.
Yeah, I think that's really important to have that compassion. It's as if, you know, the Buddha has compassion. You know, he's not, as it were, giving you a hard time.
Yeah.
And we don't need to give ourselves a hard time. Because actually it might be, you know, it might have the negative effect if we start giving ourselves a hard time. We might just go, oh, blow it all, I'm just going off.
Yeah.
Doing whatever we want to, you know, this stuff, then we feel bad about it later and we're yo-yoing between in behaviour. Whereas the more compassion, the more kindness that we can bring to ourselves, we can just say, well, I'm just trying to do my best, acknowledging those unhelpful patterns, making reparation, but then saying, well, I'm going to try and change, try and change for the better.
I think for me it's really important to move about is to not get into the whole guilty dialogue.
Yes.
I actually found that really useful in verbalising something that I've done that I feel sad about or ashamed of. It takes you out, for me, it takes me out of that loop of getting into guilty, which is really pointless actually.
Yes.
You're not moving out of that cycle.
That's right. Yeah. I think that's really good, because once we can begin to objectify it, especially if we say it to another person, because we begin to hear it anew, and they can also reflect back saying, you know, they can put it in perspective as well. You know, we might, like you say, we might get into a whole load of guilty feelings and make it the worst thing, but actually say it to someone, you know, they see it for what it is, and maybe be able to help us change our habits. Yeah.
Well, what's the difference between regret and guilt?
Yeah, good question. I wrote this down, and the answer is, Sangharakshita says guilt, because I thought this was a really good phrase. It says, guilt is the sense of having offended some greater power on which you are emotionally dependent. Wow, that's great, isn't it? Guilt is the sense of having offended some greater power on which you are emotionally dependent. So that might be some authority figure, it might be God, it might be your parents, it might be your, you know, work, it could be anything, couldn't it? You know. Whereas what we're getting at more is regret, or what in Buddhism you might call like positive shame. So it's not sort of shame as in guilt, but it's something, it's a heartfelt regret. We sincerely regret having harmed ourselves or other people. And it's not through, oh, I've done wrong, I'm a bad person. It's just this heartfelt regret. There's a sense of almost we blush with our own unskillfulness. Okay, oh, I really wish I hadn't have done that. I don't want to do that again. And it's something very, something very almost, it could be almost tender. And it can be painful, but it's a it can be positive. It can be very positive. I don't know, does that help at all, Jed, or would you, or not?
Yeah, it definitely helps.
Yeah.
Because just, I know I can get into the shift between guilt and regret.
Yeah.
They're quite subtle.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, guilt creates anxiety.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas regret, I feel like a sense of sadness.
Yes. I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I think I've noticed that when I feel guilt and fear go hand in hand. And it is this, we're fearing love is going to be taken away from us, aren't we? So, and that's terrifying.
Or approval,
yeah. So we're scared. Yeah.
Can you not have one without the other? Can you not have guilt without fearing of losing something? Can you not have guilt without not really for something you did that's not going to offend you? You know, like, you know, you hurt an animal, no one will know about it, but you did something that was bad, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and you feel emotionally aware about it.
Well, I guess we wouldn't say that's guilt, maybe that's regret.
I would say it was guilt.
Yeah.
I would definitely say that was guilt.
I think it's...
Because I'd feel I would be judging myself I would feel guilty as a crime.
No.
Whereas I would be regretting it. I would regret it also if it would be the emotion which would be the bigger thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's like guilt is sort of it's like you're culpable, you're responsible in the way that you've just described it.
Mm.
Maybe. When I think of guilt versus regret, I tend to think of guilt being somehow wallowing in how I feel about the situation, whereas regret's more
for me
sincere because it's you feel sorry for what how it affected that other person.
Yeah.
The two are the same part of the things. I mean, because emotions are quite transient and they reflect upon each other. And if I see a hurt that I've caused and I feel me as a cause of that hurt, that is an instant, that's an instant feeling there.
Yeah.
You know, where it's sort of like, like compassion. You might feel a certain way, and it's there. That judgment is upon yourself. Whereas, you know, it's not something. This is a very different thing to me. Regretting a decision about accounts or banking or doing something that's unaffecting someone else.
I think we just probably need to just explore maybe this for ourselves. Maybe it's just a matter of terminology.
I wanted to just quickly say, if I could, I think what I was hearing when I was talking with Morris, something, there is a phrase, I don't want to get too stuck on words, they call irrational guilt. And it's something like, I think I used to experience something like that more. It's like, walk down the street and I'm afraid that people, they're looking at me and thinking, they're disapproving how I'm walking out the street, how I've opened the door, you know, he's a complete bozo because he's wearing a slightly naff shirt. A friend has said this, that his mum had that fear. Someone comes down the garden path and there's fear. You know, someone goes away again and there's fear. It's just quite a lot of, I can't say really, but something to do with our own self-worth, I think. You know, a sense of worthiness, you know, that everything I do is going to be wrong. And that's what I think, whether that's the type of guilt, I think it's sort of just, you know, irrational guilt that, you know, that I'm no good, sort of.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think, so Buddhism would seek to distinct between that sort of emotion, where we're fearing the removal of, you know, the removal of love, you know, or disapproval from a higher authority. And what we're trying to get at is more this heartfelt regret, which is a lot more linked in with how we've acted. So we're nearly at time, but I just wanted to draw out just briefly the difference between natural and conventional morality. So...
Can I just say something?
Yeah, sure.
It just brought back to me a Tibetan teaching, which puts that more in context. It's more like an action plan. Regardless of whether you guilt or what, whether you've murdered someone, whether killed an animal, or whatever you've done, it's part of there's some kind of prayer where you invoke the power of regret, the power of commitment, the power of action, and there's a fourth power. It's part of a... This has happened. Rather than wallowing in feeling about it, then use it as a spur to change the future. Your action in the future. It's the first step. Four-step process to go beyond acknowledgement, commitment, action. I don't know. I don't remember the full.
Great. No, sounds good.
So,
thank you.
Yeah.
So, just looking at the difference between natural and conventional morality. So we're talking about this idea of karma, what we're confessing our unskillful actions. This is very much this sense of natural morality, natural ethics. Well, we shouldn't mix it up with conventional morality. We don't have a lot of time to go into it, but you know, maybe we feel bad about all sorts of things. But is that really an ethical matter? And this is something where we confess, our spiritual friend can help us understand whether it's a real confession, if you like, something we need to change, or it's just, you know, maybe we've, you know, I don't know, to use a silly example, maybe, you know, we feel we shouldn't wear certain clothes, types of clothes. Well, is that a matter of actual ethics, or is that a matter of conventional morality? Okay, so finishing off with confession, if the confession is effective, then there should be a definite step forward. We should be free from our unhelpful habits. And we can just put it behind us, put our negative, unskillful habits behind us, and there can be a feeling of freedom and lightness. So it's very much moving us in this direction. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the next few weeks, we're going to be exploring further the Bodhicharyavatara, and we're going to start looking at the paramitas, which are the perfections which the Bodhisattva embarks on. So look forward to seeing you again next week.